Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday the 14th of June, these are our main stories. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has condemned what he calls racist thuggery after police in London were attacked by far-right demonstrators. Thousands of people in France have taken part in protests against police violence. Four European countries have signed a deal to buy 400 million doses of a coronavirus vaccine still being tested. Also in this podcast, the Dalai Lama tells the BBC how he's hopeful some good may come out of the coronavirus crisis.
Negative things, sometimes helpful, develop a sense of concern, compassionate feeling.
After a day of violence in central London, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said racist thuggery has no place on our streets. Demonstrators had gathered outside Parliament in Westminster saying they wanted to protect monuments, including a statue of Britain's wartime leader, Winston Churchill. Several police officers were injured during clashes in which they were kicked, punched and pelted with bottles by protesters. A march by Black Lives Matter activists to Parliament was called off by the organisers. Britain's Interior Minister, Priti Patel, said that anyone attacking the police would be met with the full force of the law.
I have said every single day, as have the police around the country and in London, that these protests, these gatherings are illegal and we have been discouraging them. Secondly, we have seen a small minority behave in extreme thuggery and violent behaviour today. That is simply unacceptable. And the individuals that are basically putting the safety of our police officers and the safety of the public at risk will expect to face the full force of the law.
More than 100 people were arrested for offences including violent disorder and assault on police. Our correspondent Dominic Casciani spent the day in central London.
From mid-morning, hundreds of men, most of whom were already drinking, crowded into Parliament Square. Some were members of football hooligan networks who had put aside their differences for the day. Others were from the far right. Paul Golding, the leader of the Small Britain First group, arrived at Churchill's boarded-up statue wearing a T-shirt that read, "White Lives Matter." One protester said ordinary people were outraged at attempts by anti-racism campaigners to target the wartime leader.
Calling it for Winston Churchill's statue to be pulled down. Come on. I mean, he had some racist views, but at the end of the day, he led us through our darkest hour.
But despite claims that the day was about defending British heritage, it soon became violent. Groups looked for opportunities to attack the police. Bottles and cans were thrown at their lines and horses. Smoke bombs and fireworks set off. One bare-chested man kicked a police officer to the ground, and there were repeated attempts by others to storm barriers as the police contained the trouble. A Black Lives Matter demonstration held nearby wrapped up early, but a small number of anti-racism protesters repeatedly came close to Parliament Square, adding to the tension. By late afternoon, the crowd thinned. One man was photographed urinating next to the memorial for PC Keith Palmer, killed in the 2017 Westminster attack. Tobias Elwood MP, who had tried in vain to save the officer's life, said on Twitter, "Of all the images to emerge over these few testing days, I find this one of the most abhorrent."
That report by Dominic Casciani. To France now. The sound from protests in Paris, also against racism and alleged police brutality. On Saturday, thousands gathered in the French capital where the police fired tear gas after some demonstrators pelted them with missiles. I heard more from David Chazan in Paris.
Police say some 15,000 people gathered here, and thousands of demonstrators also rallied in other French cities. In Paris, riot police with shields and helmets prevented the protesters from marching from République to Place de l'Opéra, but they did allow them to gather in République Square. Now, a few protesters threw fireworks at police, who responded with tear gas, but the rally was largely peaceful. And police say that there are only a minority of troublemakers among the demonstrators.
Peaceful, but passions are running very high, not least because many in France are comparing the death of George Floyd in America to that of another black man in France.
Yes, many of the protesters drew parallels between George Floyd's death and a similar case in France, the death in police custody of Adama Traoré, a young black man. The Traoré case has become emblematic of the fight against racism here, and what the protesters say is police brutality against minorities in France. Adama Traoré's sister, Assa, spoke at the rally in Paris, demanding that the police officers who were allegedly involved in his death face charges. Instead, they've been cleared by an official medical report. And Assa Traoré said the protests weren't just about minorities. They were an attempt to ensure that France delivers justice for all of its citizens.
Because this is a widespread complaint, because these rallies come as France's police watchdog revealed that it had received many, many complaints against officers last year.
Yeah, that's right. Some 1,500 complaints last year, about half of them for alleged violence. And many people in poor suburbs with large minority communities have complained about heavy-handed policing during the coronavirus lockdown, when it was difficult for human rights groups to independently monitor what was going on in those areas. Complaints of racism in the police and more generally in French society are a big problem here, but the police also feel aggrieved, and they've held demonstrations themselves this week. They say enforcing the law is a tough job and they shouldn't be stigmatized and lumped together as racists, and although they sometimes make mistakes, they try to enforce the law fairly.
David Chazan. The South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has called for an end to what he described as a culture of silence around gender-based violence and urged people to report perpetrators to the police. It follows a particularly brutal killing of a woman in a Johannesburg township on Friday. Mr. Ramaphosa said there'd been a surge in such violence since coronavirus restrictions began being eased. Will Ross reports.
The news that the body of a young woman was found dumped under a tree in Soweto has prompted South Africa's president to once again express his disgust at the violence. Cyril Ramaphosa listed the names of three other women whose bodies had been found in the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal province before describing it as a dark and shameful week for the entire nation. The South African president said violent men were taking advantage of the eased restrictions on movement to attack women and children. He said the manner of the killings pointed to an unconscionable level of barbarism and a lack of humanity.
Will Ross. Officials in the Chinese capital Beijing have locked down 11 neighbourhoods after dozens of people tested positive for COVID-19. The outbreak, the first in more than a month, has sparked fears of a second wave. Thousands of people working at the city's biggest wholesale market are being tested. And the authorities have already banned sports fixtures and visitors travelling to Beijing. From there, here's our China correspondent, Stephen McDonnell.
Chinese officials aren't sure how the huge Xinfandi wholesale market, which supplies 80% of Beijing's vegetables and meat, has become the source of a new coronavirus outbreak. Hundreds of military police have entered the now locked-down facility. Nearby transport links and schools have been closed. 11 neighbourhoods close to the market have been sealed off to all but residents. After dozens of people either working at the market or visiting were infected, the authorities say they'll test more than 10,000 Xinfandi staff. Gao Xiaojun, who speaks for the Beijing Health Commission, said the authorities also wanted to test everyone who'd had recent contact with the market, as well as those living in the district surrounding it.
我是决定 The municipal government has decided to conduct tests for COVID-19 on people who are in close contact with the market since May the 30th. The Health Commission and the Department of Public Security is now developing a plan which aims to screen people in Fengtai District.
Right across Beijing, sport has been cancelled and major public facilities are pulling down the shutters again. In recent months, the Chinese government's strategy has been to completely isolate any town or city where a coronavirus cluster has emerged. This appears to have worked, but locking down all of Beijing at a time when it seems like the virus emergency had been brought under control is not something they'll want to do in a hurry.
Stephen McDonnell. Now to Hong Kong, where there's growing alarm about Beijing's plan to impose a national security law. China says a draft legislation to outlaw secession and subversion is needed to prevent a repeat of last year's demonstrations, which brought Hong Kong to a standstill. But people there are worried that it will take away the freedoms they've enjoyed since Britain handed over the territory to China. With the future looking uncertain, more people are trying to leave. Taiwan is the first choice for many. Last year, more than 5,000 Hong Kongers were granted permits to live there. But life for the arrivals isn't always easy, as Cindy Su reports from Taipei.
Despite the comfort of familiar food, at Protection Umbrella Restaurant in Taipei, the conversation is serious.
Under the British rule, there was no democracy because we couldn't vote for our governor. But there was freedom. But under the Chinese rule, the freedom is going until one day it's gone.
Hong Kong-born resident Winnie moved to Taiwan in 2014 after demonstrations against a decision by Beijing to pre-screen candidates for the election of the territory's chief executive. Last year, more Hong Kongers joined her when China tried to introduce a bill to allow people suspected of committing economic crimes to be extradited to the mainland for trial. In the kitchen, I meet one Hong Konger quietly washing dishes. He doesn't want to give his name. He's safe in Taiwan and has a work visa, but his fear remains. Taiwan allows residency for people from Hong Kong, but only if they can invest $200,000 to start a business or find a job that pays wages higher than average salaries. Otherwise, they have to be married to a Taiwanese or enrolled in university. Many don't meet the requirements and only have tourist visas. At the Jinan Presbyterian Church, Reverend Huang Chunsheng is surrounded by parishioners' children. It's a rare free moment. In recent months, he's helped more than 200 Hong Kong protesters, some of whom arrived with little more than a backpack.
Many young people come here on their own. Some school students are brought by their parents. Others are the most active protesters. Their friends have been arrested, and their parents are worried that they would be too. So they brought them here. We helped them find schools.
Reverend Huang believes the national security law would mean these young protesters would no longer have the protection of the Hong Kong courts. China could label their protests as subversive, and Communist Party officials could administer the law as if Hong Kong were any mainland city, he says. But Taiwanese society is generally conservative about allowing too many immigrants in. Even someone as well-known as Hong Kong bookseller Lam Wing-Gay isn't sure he can stay in Taiwan permanently. Mr. Lam's detention by Chinese authorities in 2015 for selling politically sensitive publications helped spark protests in Hong Kong. He's here on a temporary work permit, running the newly opened Taiwanese version of his old Causeway Bay bookstore in Hong Kong. Do you want to stay in Taiwan permanently? Do you want to go back to Hong Kong one day?
Wanting to is one thing, but whether or not I'm able to is another matter. I'm used to life here. I feel safe here, and it's a democratic society. I cannot go back to Hong Kong.
Back at the Protection Umbrella restaurant, customers tuck into their favorite Hong Kong snacks, pineapple bun with butter. Hong Kongers sit alongside locals. Some Taiwanese customers, like Ms. Lin, support Hong Kong democracy, but also want to avoid confrontation with China.
Of course. Taiwanese people really want to live their lives peacefully. People of my parents' generation fought in the war in mainland China, and it was very hard and sad for them. My generation hasn't experienced a war, and I still hope we can peacefully resolve the issues. It will be the best thing for everyone.
For Winnie and other Hong Kong immigrants, the push for eventual democracy for Hong Kong will continue, they hope, from their new home in Taiwan.
Cindy Su reporting from Taiwan. President Trump has restated his isolationist foreign policy, saying the armed forces of the United States were not the policemen of the world. Mr. Trump said it was not the job of American soldiers to rebuild other nations, but to defend the US against foreign enemies. Peter Bowes reports from Los Angeles.
Speaking at a graduation ceremony for more than 1,100 Army cadets, President Trump reaffirmed his goal of ending the era of endless wars.
In its place is a renewed, clear-eyed focus on defending America's vital interests. It is not the duty of U.S. troops to solve ancient conflicts in faraway lands that many people have never even heard of. We are not the policemen of the world.
He added that if Americans were threatened, the U.S. would not hesitate to act. Mr. Trump said his administration had embarked on a colossal rebuilding of the American armed forces.
Peter Bowes. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Miriam.
I think about our neighbours, about what they think of us clearing their land.
Oh, is it their land?
And Yusuf.
Until you came, this was our part of Jerusalem.
Two lives lived during the founding of Israel.
Will you stomach this humiliation one day longer?
A podcast drama from the BBC World Service.
Prepare for that battle. Over Jerusalem in the valley, over all of Eretz Israel.
Miriam and Yusuf.
How did we get here? We could be friends.
Search for Miriam and Yusuf. That's M-I-R-I-A-M and Y-O-U-S-S-E-F, wherever you get your podcasts.
Four EU countries and the pharmaceuticals giant AstraZeneca have signed a deal they hope could provide up to 400 million doses of a potential coronavirus vaccine for European citizens. The vaccine, being developed by scientists in Oxford, is in the second phase of human trials. Mike Saunders reports.
Huge sums are being invested in Oxford University's vaccine. There's no guarantee that it will work. Globally, AstraZeneca aims to produce 2 billion doses. The US government has secured its own $1.2 billion deal with AstraZeneca. The German Health Minister Jens Spahn said Europe was behind other countries in securing vaccines. Germany's initiative with France, Italy and the Netherlands should benefit all EU citizens, he said. European Union governments have given the European Commission a mandate to buy promising vaccines in advance, if the money is available.
Mike Saunders. The Chilean president, Sebastián Piñera, has announced the resignation of his health minister, Jaime Mañalich, as the country struggles to contain the spread of the coronavirus.
We all know that the best way to deal with the pandemic is with unity, with collaboration, with goodwill, with dialogue and agreements. And those are the paths that we have always sought as a government. And I am sure that the new health minister will lead those paths of unity, dialogue, collaboration, gathering and agreement.
Our correspondent in Santiago, Jane Chambers, told me why the health minister had to go.
Here in Chile, he's a controversial figure. Many people see him as very arrogant. They say that he doesn't listen enough to health officials about advice on what to do. Local mayors often criticise him about what he's been doing. Just recently on a TV programme, he admitted that he didn't really understand just what poor conditions some people in Santiago are living in, which goes to a big problem of this big divide between the rich and the poor here in Chile. I mean, we've had months of protests that kicked off in October. But obviously the big thing is this problem with the figures. I mean, they're saying that in the daily briefing that more than 3,000 deaths have been recorded, whereas it's recently come out that the figures they're giving to the World Health Organization are around 5,000 deaths, which is obviously much more. So that's the big reason why he's finally gone.
And who will replace him, and what will the challenges be for them?
Well, this doctor called Enrique Paris is replacing him, and there are big challenges. I mean, initially, Chile did very well. There were a low level of infections when the outbreak first started in March and relatively low deaths, and it's just spiked. And the big problem is that it's moved into much poorer areas of Santiago where social distancing is very, very difficult. And although Santiago is in this strict lockdown where we have to get permission to go out to buy food, to take a dog for a walk, only certain people are allowed to go to work, people are flouting those restrictions because they say they just have to get out to work. They're hungry. They can't stay at home. So these are some of the problems that he's facing.
Jane Chambers in Santiago. As coronavirus lockdowns are lifted and infection rates drop in many countries around the world, there are still large numbers of patients who haven't seen an improvement in their symptoms, weeks or even months after they fell ill. Peter Goffin has been speaking to some of these people who describe themselves as COVID long haulers.
The high survival rate for COVID-19 has been a rare bright spot during the pandemic. Johns Hopkins University has said more than 3 million people around the world have made a recovery from the virus. And in February, the World Health Organization said that based on preliminary Chinese data, the median recovery time is 2 weeks for mild cases and 3 to 6 weeks for severe cases. But there are thousands of people around the world who've reported ongoing, life-altering symptoms 8 or 10 or more weeks after falling ill. They haven't been hospitalized. Technically, their cases are mild, but they aren't getting better either.
It's kind of frustrating when you live it and all you see is you're fine or you die. There's definitely a spectrum of people.
Jessica Stapleton lives in the U.S. state of Indiana. Since mid-March, she's experienced around 50 different and evolving symptoms, commonly reported by longer-term patients like her, including debilitating exhaustion, shortness of breath, digestive problems, severe body pain or burning, even hallucinations, and a mental fog or confusion.
There are waves of feeling terrible and then feeling okay. You know, you wake up in the morning and you don't feel as bad as you did the night before. So you think, my body is beating this, I'm going to get better. And then afternoon hits and you don't feel okay anymore.
David Hockaday from Oxford in the UK has been experiencing a raft of physical symptoms since the 9th of March. He said it's also taking a toll on his mental health.
You find yourself on week 4 thinking there's something wrong with me, and then that it becomes a negative spiral because you're not recovering how everyone else says you should. When they ask you, how are you today? They want to hear, yeah, I'm getting much better, thanks, the linear recovery. But you can't say that.
Few of these long-term patients have been able to get tested, and for the ones who have, usually weeks into their illness, the results have come back negative, suggesting the virus itself is no longer alive in the body, though its effects are still being felt. There is very little conclusive data on COVID and its long-term impact, but these lingering symptoms are often part of the recovery process for other viral infections, according to Liam Smith, a researcher at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
That wouldn't be too surprising with COVID-19 because in the normal clinical course, a minority of people get quite acutely worse about 5 or 10 days into the illness. And a lot of that seems to be driven by inflammatory processes. And probably a lot of those are triggered by the virus triggering the body's immune system, which itself produces these much worse symptoms. So it's the body kind of trying to attack the virus. And one possibility, which is quite likely with these people who are having long-term symptoms from COVID, is that that process is continuing for weeks and weeks.
Dr. Smith says the best treatment in these cases is to very gradually build up physical and mental capacity, doing a bit of reading or walking for just a few meters at a time. And many people have turned to social media groups to cope with the emotional burden of the illness.
The only thing that's sort of keeping a lot of us going right now is connection with other people that are going through the same thing.
Raheem, who lives in London, asked us not to use his real name because he's worried about a stigma attached to having COVID.
There are Facebook groups, there are Reddit groups, and there is a Slack group. This is the only place where you can meet somebody else and speak to somebody else that's going through the same thing and understands what's going on.
Those online communities are not a cure, but they are a source of validation. And as members report their symptoms improving, and in some cases going away altogether, they're a source of hope.
That report was by Peter Goffin. The pandemic has created hardship for people across the globe, but could it also be creating positive outcomes? That's the view of the world's most prominent Buddhist leader, the Dalai Lama. He spoke to our correspondent Justin Rolat from his home in the foothills of the Himalayas, where he's been locked down since March.
How are you, Your Holiness?
Fine.
The Dalai Lama admits being locked down in a palace high in the Himalayas is pretty cushy.
I personally stay here peacefully.
He recognises the pandemic has been a terrible burden for many other people, but says there has been much to inspire and to celebrate.
There are many people that don't care about their own sort of safety, but helping, wonderful. Negative things, sometimes helpful. One way, frustration, anger. And one way, develop sense of concern, compassionate feeling. We must give our courage, our self-confidence.
His hope is that the coronavirus crisis will help foster international cooperation.
In the past, you see, we too much emphasis my continent, my nation, my religion. Now we should think humanity, 7 billion human beings.
One of the key concerns for the Buddhist leader now is the environment.
Tezpur, in the northeast of India, has become known all over the world, for it was here that India received the Dalai Lama after his flight from Tibet.
The current Dalai Lama was born in a remote village in Tibet. He was exiled in 1959.
By jeeps, the God King and his entourage travelled the last stage of their perilous 300-mile journey.
That is when the Tibetan people rose up against the Chinese occupation.
No one could have told from his unruffled bearing that the Dalai Lama had been in mortal danger since he left Lhasa.
The Dalai Lama says he has seen dramatic changes in the environment within his own lifetime.
When I was in Tibet, you see, no knowledge about environment. We take for granted any water we can drink. 1960, I came here. That winter, Dharamsala, lot of snow. Then each year, less and less and less. So we must think very seriously, global warming.
Now to an even more delicate subject, His Holiness's death. He has said he may not be reincarnated and therefore could be the last Dalai Lama.
Dalai Lama institution, now a few centuries, now end with this great Dalai Lama.
So are you saying you are the last
Dalai Lama? If the concerned people should discuss about the future of Dalai Lama, they should decide. I have no idea. My main concern is my own... my own life, spent something useful, then finished.
The Dalai Lama has been an extraordinarily effective ambassador for the Tibetan people since the Chinese invasion of Tibet 70 years ago. He may say he's not interested in what happens when he's gone, but his passing will inevitably raise major geopolitical as well as religious issues.
That was Justin Rolat speaking to the Dalai Lama. For the first time, Queen Elizabeth's official birthday has been marked with a military ceremony in the grounds of Windsor Castle. The traditional Trooping the Colour on Horse Guards Parade in London was cancelled because of the pandemic. But as our royal correspondent Nicholas Witchell reports, the soldiers carried out a series of manoeuvres which had been specially designed to maintain social distancing.
It was a birthday parade for changed times. Windsor Castle substituted for Horse Guards Parade. There were no crowds and no cavalry. But under perfect summer skies, into the castle's central quadrangle, marched the soldiers who formed the castle guard, accompanied by the rather less than massed bands of the Household Division. And on this, the day that officially marks her 94th birthday, the Queen was there to watch.
Royal Senate!
She emerged from the castle where she's been in isolation with her husband since the start of the coronavirus lockdown.
Hello.
Social distancing was very much the order of the day. The Welsh guards and the bandsmen were standing at least 2 metres apart. They'd all learnt new marching techniques to maintain safe distances. March! For 20 minutes, the troops manoeuvred on the castle's lawns, closely watched by the guest of honour. The colour of the Welsh Guards was paraded past the Guard of Honour, just 18 soldiers rather than the 1,400 who would normally attend trooping the colour. Yet for all that it was scaled down, this birthday parade of 2020, the first official engagement by the monarch since the start of the lockdown, represented a note of hope that, very slowly and very carefully, life can start to be restored to a version of normality.
Nicholas Witchell. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.